Creation.
Pickle. K-sore.
Kitten.
Camp.
See, wait. You. Unbearable.
U is for underground.
Oh, yeah.
Umbrella.
T. Trite.
Tremendous.
Torment.
Tire.
C. K.
I can't think of a U one. T.
T.
F is for famous.
Fun. Fumble. M is for Montreal.
My name is Scott Nye, and this is Talking Radical Radio. Hello, and welcome to Talking Radical Radio, where we bring you grassroots voices from across Canada. We give you the chance to hear many different people who are facing many different struggles talk about what they're doing, how they're doing it, and why they're doing it, in the belief that such listening is a crucial step in strengthening all of our efforts to change the world. On this week's show, I'll be speaking with Wendy Wilson and Rachel Zellers. There have been people of African descent living in Nova Scotia for more than 400 years. The long histories of the province's many deeply rooted black communities are bound up with histories of slavery and with past and present realities of anti-black racism, but also with histories just as long and deep of survival, resistance, and thriving. As was the case in a number of jurisdictions across North America, one element of that history was segregated schools. Black children and youth were not allowed to go to the same schools as white kids, and black schools were much more poorly resourced. Considering this disparity, black communities and black teachers were pretty successful in making sure that their kids got a good education, but it was still a major injustice. The formal end of segregated schooling in the mid-20th century was nominally meant to address that injustice, but it's actually a lot more complicated than that. In Nova Scotia, the end of the old separate and unequal system also meant that black students were no longer learning primarily with other black students and from black teachers. Their schools had been black spaces in a hostile anti-black world where students were nurtured and supported and were seen as whole human beings with potential. Integrated schools in Nova Scotia were not just predominantly non-black, but often profoundly and systemically anti-black, with all of the surveillance, policing, dehumanization, and discrimination that entails. As one of today's participants put it, quote, "Our education system is a site of violence for many, many, many black children," end quote. One response to this reality that began in the U.S. in the 1960s, in the context of the civil rights movement phase of the long black freedom struggle, was what were called freedom schools. These were grassroots educational spaces created by black educators and activists, where black children and youth could learn about their history, about themselves and their communities, and about leadership and action, and where they could be supported and nurtured. Particularly since the most recent upsurge in the black freedom struggle since 2013 under the banner of Black Lives Matter, freedom schools have once again been appearing in communities across North America. Rachel Zellers is an African-American lawyer, scholar, and community organizer who has lived in Canada for more than a decade and a half and in Halifax for the last couple of years. Though she's relatively new to the community, as an educator and a mother of teens herself, she realized that a freedom school in Nova Scotia could be a powerful contribution. They didn't know each other, but she'd heard of Wendy Wilson, and she gave her a call. Wilson is an African Nova Scotian teacher, artist, writer, and community advocate whose family has been in the province for at least 8 generations. After that initial phone call, Wilson called together a number of other African Nova Scotian educators that she knew, and they got down to planning. Zellers brought a sample lesson plan, and the others adapted it to make it specific to the African Nova Scotian context. They decided on 2 two-hour sessions each week during the month of August, of course to be held online in this year of COVID-19. The first week focused on policing issues and the movement to defund the police. The second was about African Nova Scotian history and culture. The third week was about leadership, and the final week was about activism. According to what they saw during the course of it and what they have heard from the young people themselves and their parents since, the African Nova Scotian Freedom School was a great success. They plan to stay connected with this year's participants and to host another Freedom School next year. And for Wilson in particular, this is one small part of a larger, long-standing vision in the community, being led by an organization called the Afrocentric Learning Institute, to eventually open an Afrocentric school in Nova Scotia. I speak with Wilson and Zellers about the African Nova Scotian Freedom School.
My name is Wendy Wilson. I am an African Nova Scotian. I'm an educator as well as an artist, and I do some writing as well, and I consider myself a community advocate. My family is about 8 generations deep here in Nova Scotia. I've always been involved in the community. That involvement started when I was just a little girl with my father, who did pastoral work in the community and was a community advocate. He taught me that the most important thing is family, and then further reaching beyond that is giving back to the community. One of the tenets of Afrocentricity is to work collaboratively with the community and not necessarily think about what's good for an individual, but think about what's good for the whole. When I really intentionally started working in grassroots organizations was when I left the community school that I worked in the inner city of Halifax. I worked in the community school there for 12 years, and the school was comprised mainly of African Nova Scotian students at the time. I realized that being outside of the community, I felt like I needed to ground myself in community work. So I intentionally started doing some writing around culture and what is African Nova Scotian culture. One of the very first things that I did was started to do some of my own informal research on African Nova Scotian food. I wrote a few pieces about that and just really started a conversation. And at that point, 7-8 years ago, we weren't talking about it. We weren't naming what our traditional foods were. We weren't naming what our traditional clothing or music was. Then one of the next things that I did was I did a bit of research and created the African Nova Scotian flag, because up until this point, we didn't have one. I'm involved in several boards and organizations. It gets rather busy, but I know that I'm doing it for the good of the community.
I'm Rachel Zellers. I'm an assistant professor at St. Mary's University. I am also a lawyer and a community organizer. I'm also a mother to 3 teenagers, which is absolutely my most important job. I am an African American who's been in Canada for the last 17 years and chose Nova Scotia very intentionally as my home after living in Quebec for a long time. The history of Black people's lives here and a sense of kinship was the primary driving factor. And so I'm someone who came here with intention and also came here with a desire to learn, to serve in ways that this community found useful, and really to take a back seat. You know, as someone who's an academic and a researcher and a lawyer, I'm very aware of the ways in which we like to position ourselves as authorities. And so one of the most important things about who I am and about who I am as a grassroots organizer is learning when I need to shut up and listen and be led, and how to lead in ways that don't displace or minimize what came well before me and what is rooted in a place much more deeply than I may be. In terms of my grassroots organizing, you know, I can't imagine or think of a time when I didn't serve. My grandmother, my mother's father, was a Baptist minister. And she was a woman of faith and service in the Newark, New Jersey community. My summers were spent with her. And so, you know, my grandmother, without knowing, without expressing it, without me even being consciously aware of it, as I became an adolescent and young woman, directed my pathway to service. I really can't think of a time when I haven't given back, given something organized with other people in some capacity.
The African Nova Scotian Freedom School was an opportunity for students in the province of Nova Scotia to take part in a one-month online program that involved students getting to know who they are as African Nova Scotians, the history, also a chance for students to mobilize and think about activism and how they can be active in the community, promoting their culture and fighting for equality. They also had the opportunity to learn about what leadership looks like in the African Nova Scotian community. So the students came on twice a week for the month of August for 2 hours. There were, I think, 7 or 8 of us in terms of instructors that led them through the process.
Absolutely an environment where our children are seen, heard and listened to, believed, not punished, directed. Directed in the context of learning about who they are, who their people are, and also guided towards service. The questions that we centered throughout the month were questions of who are you? Who are your people? And what are your responsibilities? Why do we serve? Why do we give? And then how do you serve? So I think of the African Nova Scotian Freedom School as a program that allows Black children, Black youth to be seen and heard in all that they are, in the fullest version of themselves.
For me, primarily, the most important thing was that students of African descent had the opportunity, probably the very first opportunity, to have all Black instructors focusing on a curriculum that was centered around them. And also, as one of the instructors, I had the chance to collaborate with other like-minded people with a similar agenda in planning how the program would look.
Tell listeners a bit more about Freedom Schools in general and the history that they come out of.
Freedom Schools were developed in the wake of the 1954 Brown v. Board of Education decision, which was, of course, the famous decision in the United States that got rid of segregated school systems. But it got rid of segregated school systems only de jure in the context of the law. Segregated schooling in the United States, as a very relevant case example, is even more entrenched now than it was after the Brown v. Board of Education decision. Freedom Schools, beginning in the early to mid 1960s, arose because as schools started to very slowly integrate, the cost of integration became very clear to Black parents, Black educators, and Black principals. An enormous percentage of our Black educators and principals disappeared as, you know, white principals and a dominantly white and female teaching force became the heads of all of our integrated schooling systems in the United States. And so Black parents, who are the most brilliant and attentive to our children's needs, always saw what was happening. And because this transition coincided with the civil rights movement, Black parents got together with educators and principals and set up freedom schools that would continue to be places that centered the emotional, spiritual, and educational needs of Black children. And in the context of the civil rights movement, freedom schools prepared Black children to be leaders, really instilled in Black children that if you are breathing, you owe what your ancestors made for you. And so the concept of leadership embedded into freedom schools is really a spiritual foundation and obligation that we pass on to our children that you owe back. And you owe back because you're alive. Your very existence has to honor those that came before you. Freedom schools like the Toronto Freedom School and the Chicago Freedom School that my children were enrolled in June have become spaces that not only give a nod to this history, but also are very much in step and in rhythm with the kind of violences that Black children and youth continue to face in our public school systems and our private school systems. I mean, there's just an endless volume of information, scholarly research, reports that remind us and keep clarifying that public schools, private schools, our education system is a site of violence for many, many, many Black children. And so the new generation of freedom schools that have arisen have just undertaken the challenges of these realities and created spaces where not only the same traditions are upheld, but these spaces, and this is close to my heart as a queer Black woman, have also been spaces that embrace Afrocentric principles without the lineage of patriarchy and homophobia that unfortunately has been interwoven in certain threads of Afrocentricity in the past. Our freedom schools are places where we acknowledge the wholeness of our people, where we say all of us are none of us. They're spaces that allow us to embrace the fullness of who our children are and are becoming.
How did this summer's African Nova Scotian Freedom School come about?
I got a call from Rachel Zellers earlier this year about possibly setting up a freedom school.
And I feel infinite amounts of gratitude towards Wendy for just taking that call and listening to me. We literally connected out of the blue. She didn't know me from Jack. That first conversation was such an important one.
Some of the reasons why we started the African Nova Scotian Freedom School are really in line with some of the conversations that would have been happening 70, 80 years ago. We had a segregated school system here in Nova Scotia up until the 50s, with over 50 communities spread from Cape Breton to Yarmouth. Many of the schools in these small communities were not necessarily substandard in terms of teachers, but many of the communities would have had to fundraise the money to build a space where school could take place and then find educators to staff these positions in the schools. Many of them wouldn't have been like certified teachers because at the time, the teachers' college did not admit Black folks. But during this time of segregation, it was a good quality of education compared to the resources that were at hand. When I say that, what I mean is that the teachers that were teaching in these schools were from the community. They were African Nova Scotian teachers for the most part, other people of African descent that worked in these schools. So for us, our teachers were invested. And no one was ever complaining about the quality of education. What they wanted is they wanted opportunities. They wanted choice. In Nova Scotia, I hear older folks, people in their 60s that were part of the segregated school system, talk so fondly about their experience in the education system. When schools were desegregated, community schools were dispersed, and we kind of farmed our children out to people who didn't have a vested interest, strangers. And if we could have only combined the two, the people in the community that looked like the children, that had a vested interest in the children, but if we could have also acquired the resources and the buildings and the books, if we could have put those two things together, then we could assure our students' success. Right now, as a public school student, you're unlikely to even have one Black teacher. And what we do know about having educators that look like you is that if you have a Black teacher that looks like you by the fifth grade, you are more likely to graduate from high school.
This point that Wendy is raising, for me, it's at the center of my heart and my thinking whenever I think of my parenting, my children, and it certainly was the driving force behind the African Nova Scotian Freedom School. I think it's important to share something that I learned, that there is a much larger project, the group of educators in this community who for years and years have been the grounding force of ALI, the Afrocentric Learning Institute, and whose visionary commitment is to create a school for our children, a program that is not unlike the schools that have been invested in for folks who identify as Acadian or Mi'kmaq peoples in this province, but a space that also acknowledges our long line of hundreds of years of history that also uniquely situate our people and our children in this place. I just feel like it's important to acknowledge the people in our community that have been working for literally decades, whose visionary commitment is to give birth to that school and that program that Wendy has also been a part of. The Freedom School is like, you know, a drop in the bucket in relationship to this project that has to grow and has to become real in this community. And so the Freedom School really started on that initial call. Wendy called a meeting of educators that she's known and organizes with. When we came together, what I realized was how much I would learn and how grateful I felt that our children would be able to be in front of these very committed, experienced, and loving, frankly, educators for a month over the summer. One of the things that I remember is how quickly, because of the intimacy and kinship that everyone had, folks were able to say, oh, here's what I'd like to teach. Oh, actually, you know, I'm really good at this. I already have something I've been working on curriculum-wise related to this subject. And there was this almost organic process of educators tag teaming. That for me also feels very important, because if I could think of like the non-substantive stuff I wanted children to get, I wanted them to witness our Black bodies in front of them all for that month of August. But I also wanted them to have as much insight into the ways that we work collectively, that we work together, that we supported each other, that we planned together, that we struggled together, that we didn't give up on one another, making decisions together, holding and sharing power together.
And I have to say, selfishly, that having the opportunity to talk about our experiences as educators with the other instructors is something that I jumped right on, because our experience as African Nova Scotian educators in the public school system is the same experience that our students are having. So imagine being the only Black staff member in the school and not having the opportunity to be able to collaborate with, you know, people that share a culture and a history. So when we met to talk about what the curriculum would look like, Rachel had already done an outline of the 4 weeks. But then Rachel very graciously took a back seat and allowed us as African Nova Scotians to unapologetically focus specifically on African Nova Scotian culture. Like we didn't have to keep saying, oh, we mean, you know, all Black people, or we're not. We were aiming the curriculum at the African Nova Scotian experience, the history and the culture. And that doesn't normally happen without, you know, saying, oh, well, we got to include other groups as well. So these students were hearing about the culture that has taken a back seat for so long, and hence the reason why parents were asking, like, how can we get involved in this? We've already missed an opportunity in the public school system, but are we able to make it up somehow? Is there something that you can do for us so that we can be grounded in our culture as well? So the first week was around policing and defunding the police and kind of an overview of that. And then the second week I did with Malik Adams and Kim Kane, and we did the week of Who Are We? So culture and history. And then the third week, the topic was leadership. And then the fourth week was Where Do We Go From Here? Activism. Like, how do we put these themes into action?
What kinds of things were discussed in the leadership and activism weeks of the Freedom School?
One of the things that they did is they talked about the components, like what is leadership? What does it mean to be a leader? And then they gave examples of notable, and I don't want to say unnotable, but people that you wouldn't normally consider leadership. So they took a look at what leadership can look like in different capacities and the skills and the characteristics that they then needed to become leaders as well. And then throughout the entire Freedom School, it was very important to me to talk to these students about them doing the documentation. If we're trying to, quote unquote, legitimize our culture, what could they do in order to help that cause?
And I'll answer this question threefold. I believe that there's no greater power that an educator offers than representation for Black children and Black youth. And not just any representation, but good representation. So showing up, being that body, and leading with a particular kind of care and excellence. So the leadership that happened in the Freedom School happened via these kids being in relationship with 9 community members and adults who had a full-time 9-to-5, but also have as part of our life community work that we undertake. That is an embodiment of leadership. You can't just stop at your 9-to-5. As someone who lives in community, you also have to give in these particular ways. And so that for me was one of the ways that leadership was expressed. I watched the children become leaders to one another. I watched students who were a bit shy initially learn to take up space and find their voice. And it is powerful beyond measure for young Black kids to sit with their peers and hear them speak and be affirmed. And then thirdly, what I wanted was for our current moment and the ideas that are hyper circulating through it, defunding the police, calls for abolition. I wanted our young people to be stopped in their tracks and start a conversation internally, and then hopefully in ways that would ripple out in their families, communities, and in their friendships about these very complicated and controversial notions of what prison abolition looks like, what it is, what are the fear spots that exist within us, and what is defunding the police? Is it really such a radical idea, or is it simply a point on that timeline that leads us to abolition well into the future? So there was a kind of leadership that I envisioned in, you know, planting these seeds of ideas that I knew would ripple out.
What kind of feedback have you heard from the young people who participated in the Freedom School?
My son is in school with one of the teenagers who is in the Freedom School, and his mother called me one morning. She had moved her son from a school where he was encountering a lot of peer violence and apathy from the principal and from his educators who refused to intervene in the kind of racial violence he was facing in his school. And she called me to say, I can't tell you how much confidence and grounding that month gave my son. She said, having him sit in front of the computer and then listening, you know, as a mom who was sort of scurrying around the house, watching his confidence grow over that month confirmed to me exactly what he needed and that we had made the right decision in removing him from this school system where his principal over years responded to our concerns of racial violence with apathy. My son was heard and seen every time that he was before all of you on Tuesday and Thursday. So I can't thank you enough.
One of the overriding themes that I heard students saying was they're just like me. And I think I know what student you're talking about, Rachel. And his mother, one of the things that she had mentioned to me is that her son finally felt like he found his people.
Mm-hmm.
Those were his words. Mom, I found my people. A place without apology where he could be himself, learn about himself. And most importantly, it's a place where these students felt comfortable. They didn't have to explain what they meant or be afraid that someone was going to make fun of them or wouldn't know what they were talking about. We, as African Nova Scotians, get each other.
You have been listening to my interview with Rachel Zellers and Wendy Wilson about the African Nova Scotian Freedom School. To learn more about it, go to freedomschoolns.wixsite.com. To find out more about Talking Radical Radio, the guests, the theme music, and the ways that you can listen, go to talkingradical.ca and click on the link for the radio show. On the site, you can sign up for email updates or follow us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, SoundCloud, and other platforms. I'm Scott Nye, a writer and media producer based in Hamilton, Ontario, and the author of 2 books of Canadian history told through the stories of activists published by Fernwood Publishing. Thank you very much for listening, and I hope you tune in again next week.
Early in the morning, before before the sun rose, when the first bird sang, even while everyone was still asleep.
Morning. On that morning.
When the sun comes out.
This morning, baby.
Cock-a-doodle-doo. I hear the rooster crowing.
Now you must wake up.
Now every morning when I wake up,
I woke up this morning with
the kiss of the morning.
Got up 7:30 every morning. Had the same breakfast.
Réveillez-moi à 8 heures demain matin.
Good morning.
Early in the morning.
Early in the morning.
Riding a bike made of bacon and eggs.
In the morning.
In the morning.
The sun replace the
moonlight. Has this ever happened to any of you, or will it happen to any of you on the morning after the night before?
You are listening to The Morning After on CKUT 90.3 on the FM dial.
Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
It also has to be true that we see the whole world as sacred. Why would one place be more important than another? That when we lose track of the fact that all of the world should be sacred in that bigger sense, then we're in trouble. Because when we start to designate some places as important and sacred and other places as not important, then inevitably we do greater damage to those places we've deemed not sacred.
That's the voice of Robert Jensen. On this week's show, we speak to Robert Jensen regarding his latest book, Plain Radical: Living, Loving, and Learning to Leave the Planet Gracefully. Stay tuned.
We are live with Dr. Robert Jensen. Thank you so much for joining us. Thinking about the world and the crises that we face are multiple. You know, we face an economic crisis, an ecological crisis, a social and political ramifications of living in the world that is mired with hierarchies. How do we engage in the world in a way that allows us to live more gracefully, recognizing our interconnection with one another?
Well, that's a great struggle that people have always had to deal with who have a critique of the way systems, big systems of power, work in the world. And I think the answer is that we all find a balance between the amount of time, energy we commit to challenging illegitimate authority, challenging systems of power like white supremacy and patriarchy and capitalism, and how much we try to construct at the level of our day-to-day life a sane and decent community where we think about reducing our consumption and treating both, you know, the human and non-human world more gently. And different people will strike that balance in different ways. But I think as long as we hold both of those goals in mind, the need to challenge power and the need to live decent lives, whatever the balance we accomplish can contribute to the possibility of a better world.
In your latest book, Plain Radical: Living, Loving, and Learning to Leave the Planet Gracefully, you write about your friend Jim Copeland and about the lessons that you learned from him as to how do we navigate this world of at times what seems to be counter actions, and yet the importance of recognizing our situatedness and our interrelatedness to one another.
Right. Well, Jim Copeland is a name that people won't recognize unless they knew him personally, because he wasn't famous. He didn't write books, but he was a lifelong activist and had to deal with these questions starting in the 1960s through all of the important movements in the last half of the 20th century. And the first thing Jim would say is that the balance he struck in his life was not for everybody. Everybody should figure this out on their own. But he participated in movements. You know, he participated in the civil rights movement in the U.S., the anti-war movements. He dedicated a lot of his life to feminist movements. But he also tried to be part of decent communities on the ground level. He was a lifelong gardener, and he believed the skills that one cultivates in the garden are important. He contributed to community groups that were focused on the arts or on more social and cultural questions, believing that you have to build strong connections to human beings on the ground. And so the book is really an attempt to tell both the story of Jim and the philosophy behind how he made those decisions to help people who are struggling themselves come to their own conclusions about that.
You talk about the connection between our mind and our body, recognizing that we are, you know, above all things, living beings, just like, you know, all the other sentient beings that share the earth with us. How do we then locate the traces of colonization, of imperialism, that demarcate on our bodies the trauma, the terror that we are forced to live with at times?
It's crucial. And of course, in the modern, you know, high technology world, we're increasingly disembodied. Obviously, we still have bodies and still walk in the world. But take the obvious example of the proliferation of screens and how much of our understanding of the world comes through a screen, whether it's the computer or a smartphone or the movie screen or the television screen or the video game. You know, for many people, a real connection to the larger living world is largely mediated through screens. In effect, it's kind of disembodied. Now, I don't believe everybody has to go throw away their computers, but recognizing that even for those of us living fairly privileged lives, this question of the body is very important. How do we stay connected to that larger living world? And my friend Jim, you know, was a big believer that that was crucial to progressive politics. As I said, he connected to the world in a really profound way through gardening. You know, he'd grown up on a farm, and his body and its connection to the dirt was very important to him. Of course, in other situations, these questions of the body are much more distressing when we think about, you know, the violence of patriarchy and how that's visited upon primarily women's bodies. The struggle to achieve dignity in much of the third world because of the incredible imbalance in the distribution of wealth and power. There, the problems of the body are much more tangible and obvious. But, you know, these are questions that are meaningful for all of us, no matter where we live, in a sense.
I was thinking about the way you write your story is quite touching and very vulnerable, you know, in the way that you allow the reader to see you at your most naked. And I think that there's a certain power in being this open, you know, with your story, with, you know, in the sharing of our stories, because as you point out in your book, most people tend to want to tell their story of how they succeeded, how their power makes them, you know, this unique or, you know, standalone kind of personality. I see the invitation as your reader as one that is a vulnerability, as one that invites me to engage in my own story as well. But I wonder, how do you see that story connecting to other stories?
Thank you for that comment, because that was an important part of the book for me. There are really two things I was trying to emphasize that I think are especially important for people like me who are academics or writers. You know, a lot of us who teach and write for a living, we tell a story, as you point out, that makes us look really good. Like, here are these great ideas we've come to, as if somehow we, you know, have magic gifts that allow us to do this. But in my case, the ideas I've been writing and teaching about for the last 30 years really formed in collaboration with this friend, Jim Coplin. And by writing about that, I was, you know, recognizing that none of us build our ideas alone, that these are all collaborative. In my case, there was a particularly important collaboration with this one person, but Jim would be the first to recognize that his own ideas came in similar fashion through this interaction with other people. So, you know, we don't do it alone is one lesson. And the vulnerability is a reminder that, you know, when we achieve some success in life, and I'm a, you know, professor at a big university, so I'm successful in some sense, it's easy to avoid talking about the ways we are broken and vulnerable and weak and afraid. And I think for people in those positions of authority to do that is especially important. And that was a big part of how I came to understand the world, was by, instead of trying to ignore my own pain and my own vulnerabilities, through this work with Jim Coplan, I was able to open up and see those as a source of not only suffering personally, but a source of insight that, you know, we don't learn about the world only through our brains and this sort of disembodied thinking. We learn about the world through our engagement with it. And inevitably, if we're human, that means not only triumph and success, it means suffering and pain. And so all of this is part of, you know, every human experience. And I was just trying to write honestly about it, recognizing that I have this incredible privilege at this point in my life. I'm older, I'm established, I have the ability to write books, and I wanted to write as honestly as I could. I don't need to write a book in which I'm the hero. I think too often all of us tell stories when we're trying to make ourselves out to be the hero. And, you know, there are real heroes in the world, I suppose, but I don't feel like one of them.
I love that you not only speak about the courage to live and be open and vulnerable in order to be touched by the world and to touch the world at the same time, but you also invite us to embrace, you know, the pain, the suffering as one of our portals, perhaps, to our own greatness. Because you describe how your friend Jim refused to allow people to just skip, you know, the sadness, or when something became so hard, you know, too hard to bear, he would not let you just skip out of it, but rather engage you and invite you to sit with it and to discover what was in it. What were some of the gifts that you discover in those encounters?
Well, I think it's when we, you know, not only allow ourselves to feel sad. My friend Coplan would have said that sadness isn't really enough of a descriptor. He often talked about grief, especially when talking about the state of nature, the larger living world of which we're a part, in which we are slowly and increasingly rapidly destroying. And Jim used to make sure that people were willing in his world to sit with that grief, to engage it, because out of that grief, out of that recognition of just how much damage we've done to the world and to each other, we do come to new insights about how we might change, you know, a deeper moral reckoning. And I don't think you get to that place without the grief. Now, we live in a culture in which there's a lot of people trying to sell us perpetual happiness, you know, whether it's happiness through drugs or happiness through entertainment or whatever it might be. You know, this is a culture that doesn't want us to feel grief, for the simple reason that when people are grieving, they don't tend to spend a lot of money. And so in a mass consumption culture, you know, with all this energy and technology around us, there are a lot of easy ways to dodge the grief. And my friend Coplan simply wouldn't allow that in his own life. And to be his friend was to recognize you would have to reckon with that grief to stay in relationship to him. And that was probably the greatest gift he gave me and many other people as well. I had a very close and special relationship with Jim, but Jim had networks of people that over the 79 years of his life he had affected this way. And I think if we were all in a room and said, you know, what was special about Jim Coplan, there'd be a lot of things, but what would bind us would be the honesty with which Jim was able to look reality straight on and feel what comes from that, that sadness, that grief, and also balanced, of course, with joy. Human life is not just grief, it's also joy. And it's kind of a common theme in poetry and the arts that if you deny your capacity to grieve, you will also implicitly be restricting your ability to feel joy. And Jim Coplan really took that to heart and really understood what that meant, I think.
I love your poem. In the book, you quote Wendell Berry, and you say, "It is hard to have hope. It is harder as you grow old. For hope must not depend on feeling good. And there is the dream of love, loneliness, and absolute midnight. You also have withdrawn belief in the present reality of the future, which surely would surprise us. And hope is harder when it cannot come by prediction any more than by wishing. But stop dithering," I love this, "the young as the old to hope. What will you tell them? Tell them at least what you said to yourself."
You can never go wrong quoting Wendell Berry, in a sense. His poetry is very powerful in that way. And what was so important to me about that passage was that often people who recognize, for instance, we face these multiple ecological crises, who have some sense themselves of the depth of the problems, they'll say, "Well, people can't handle that," as if somehow you can know something and it's appropriate not to speak honestly of it to others. And so that, you know, that idea, say at least what you say to yourself, is very important, to not let the fear of how other people will react keep you from talking honestly about what you know. And again, Jim Coplan was a real model for that. He didn't go around imposing his views on everybody, but when people did engage him in conversation, he always spoke honestly. He told others what he told himself and wasn't afraid to do that.
We live in a world that is constantly presenting us with recipes, you know, recipes for the, you know, the way to grow the economy, the way to become an academic, the way to do research. There's all kinds of templates that we're being offered. And I guess in so many ways, I've been consume with this idea that we need a vision of a world that is interconnected, that is intergenerative, you know, that is constantly aware of our own presence with each other and the way we presence, you know, those with us. So how do you see us building a movement that is systematically intentional and in the path of justice, in the path of ecological interconnectedness, and gracefully walking upon the earth in a way that allows many generations, long after we've gone, to be able to thrive and continue to exist and live in this planet?
Well, I think you're absolutely right that focus on interdependence is incredibly crucial. You know, we live in a culture, again, in the contemporary United States especially, but to some degree the developed world more generally, that obsesses about independence. In the U.S., you know, we're constantly talking about liberty and freedom, yet everyone understands at some level that there's no meaningful human life if you are truly disconnected from other people, that we are interdependent by nature. That's the kind of animals we are. And then the next step, of course, is to realize that interdependence is also with the non-human world, and that the modern culture, especially the mass consumption culture of the first world, disconnects us from other people and disconnects us from the larger world. So I guess the answer to the question, how do we do that, is first of all to recognize how the dominant culture tries to keep us from that recognition. And from there, people will have different solutions. For instance, just take a look at the rise of urban gardening in the United States and beyond. A huge explosion in the number of people who want to not only garden, but garden with other people, community gardens. Okay, well, that's a recognition that we have a connection to the earth, whether we, you know, were raised that way or not, because our food comes from the earth, most obviously, and that producing food with our own hands is incredibly rewarding, especially when it's done communally. Now, you know, for most of human history, that's the way people did things, communally in a sustainable fashion with the larger living world. We didn't have to be taught how to do it. We didn't have to have programs in it, because for most of human history, that was just how we lived. But recent human history, especially the last 10,000 years, especially the last 200 years, have really kept us from, you know, what is our nature in a sense. And so I think a lot of these things you see are people's attempts to get back to what feels right. And what feels right is to be in a loving connection to other people in a way that doesn't demand we destroy the earth. And people will find different ways to do that, whether it's, you know, making sure you get time to get out of the city and spend some time, you know, walking on a trail on the edge of town. Maybe it's an hour a week of getting closer to, you know, the world without a screen in between you and that world is part of this process. And I think that's, in a sense, where the action is politically, trying to foster ways to bring people together like that, and especially together in ways that don't demand we destroy the earth.
I love that you point out that in your book that the sacred is everywhere, you know, and I think that I feel that when we connect with the earth, with everyone and everything, with a sense of sacredness, of, you know, honoring one another, there is but one place, you know, to be, and is one of co-creation, is one of, you know, reciprocity, is one where we are, you know, respectfully engaging with one another. But clearly, in a society that demarcates all our systems of, you know, of, I don't know, call it subsistence, as hierarchical structures where power and privilege cannot be ignored, how do we suspend those, you know, learned ideologies and ways of being to adopt a more sacred path of interconnection?
Maybe that's the big question. But let me go back. Something you said about the sacred got me thinking. You know, the sacred is a concept that's crucial in almost every culture. It can lead us to designate some spaces as particularly important. For instance, a temple, let's say, or in a church, can be seen as sacred space. And by that, we can mean that that's where we go to recharge, that's where we go to reflect, that we recognize a heightened sense of the sacred in that place. But at the same time, it also has to be true that we see the whole world as sacred. Why would one place be more important than another? That when we lose track of the fact that all of the world should be sacred in that bigger sense, then we're in trouble, because when we start to designate some places as important and sacred and other places as not important, then inevitably we do greater damage to those places we've deemed not sacred. You know, there's another line in the book I quote from Wendell Berry that really drives that home for me as part of a larger poem. He says, "There are no unsacred places. There are only sacred places and desecrated places." And I think by that, Wendell Berry means we have to understand the whole world is part of this living earth, and it's all sacred in some sense. And it's only places that we humans have chosen to desecrate, to treat with less respect, that become, in a sense, waste, become unimportant. So if we think about it that way, then the toughest, you know, neighborhood in an urban setting that's all concrete and asphalt and broken bottles is every bit as much as sacred as a pristine mountaintop. It's all sacred because it's all part of the ecosphere. It's all part of this incredibly creative life force. And that's a move that's very important, away from thinking about life simply as a property of organisms. You're alive, Sylvia. I'm alive. The plant is alive. In some sense, that's obviously true. But in another sense, a bigger sense, we can think of the whole earth as being alive, that life is a property of the ecosphere. And that leads us to a different attitude, I think, and a different way of treating the earth. We're not as quick to describe some places as important and other places as garbage. Now, you keep going to the practical. How do you actually, you know, achieve that in the world? And again, some of it's about how we think differently, how we talk and come up with new ideas. But I think you're right that it's also about how we build that into our daily lives. Again, let me go back to my friend Jim and this renewed interest in in gardening and in so many urban areas. When you garden, even if it's just planting a couple of tomato plants, right, it puts your hands into the soil. It reconnects you in a very foundational way to this larger living world. And I think that's a good example of that. Now, you know, everybody gardening isn't going to change the world because these structures of power are still there. But when we can reconnect to both the earth and to each other through these communal and collaborative practices, I think it builds our resilience to tackle these systems of power, which we should recognize aren't going away anytime soon. You know, the fact that you and I can agree capitalism is destructive, capitalism is incompatible with a sustainable human presence on the planet, doesn't mean capitalism is going away tomorrow. So we need to build the resilience to keep fighting, even though perhaps in our own lifetime we'll never achieve that victory. And the only way I know to do that is to recharge with other people and to recharge with the earth.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much for being with us. I love your book, Plain Radical. It's just a very touching homage of what is clearly a very dear friend of yours. And I think with loss, we often get so mired in the grief that we lose the gift that life is a cycle, it's part of a cycle, you know, and we're all in that cycle of creating life and generating life. So in parting, what would you encourage our listeners? How would you encourage them to embrace this invitation? Because we are living in very difficult times, but within this hardship, there is an invitation, and, you know, that each and every one of us can take up.
My friend Jim Coplin, who would be very embarrassed by all this conversation about him because he was a very quiet and humble person. I think what he would say is, first of all, start where you live. Look around. Who are your neighbors? What do they need? What can you do with them? You know, in the end, I think if we can't construct decent communities, if we can't be decent to each other, we don't have a lot of hope politically. And so the answer to that question is going to differ depending on who you are and where you live. For Jim, in addition to gardening, it was volunteering at a community arts project. It was, you know, going to the neighborhood cafe and you know, making sure there were fresh flowers from his garden in the vases because that beauty was important to him. It was about connecting to the people who had coffee in the morning at that cafe. It was all those little things that help create communities that enrich our lives instead of stress us out. And everybody will find different ways to do that. And the message Jim would leave us with is, don't use my life as a model. Don't try to replicate what I've done. Look around you and ask, what do you want to do yourself? And there you'll find the inspiration.
Beautiful. Thank you so much for being with us. How can our audience reach you? Find your books. How can they connect with your work?
If you put my name into a search engine, Robert Jensen, the first page that comes up will be my page, and there's an archive of material people can read for free and a list of books, a couple of which are also online for free, as well as an email address and phone number if anybody wants to get in touch.
Thank you.
Red alert. The spread of COVID-19 is at a critical level in your area or a neighboring region. Getting together with family or friends is prohibited, and traveling to other regions is not recommended. More targeted restrictions have been put into place to limit the spread and prevent a lockdown. Learn more at quebec.ca/coronavirus. Continue to wash your hands, keep a 2-meter distance, and wear a mask when physical distancing is impossible. We need to act now. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
When your parents need your help, you're there. When your kids say something's wrong, you're there. When your friends have a rough day, you're there. Be there for yourself the way you're there for others, as it's normal for these uncertain times to bring out negative emotions or anxiety. If you're finding it difficult to carry out daily tasks, there are solutions. Visit quebec.ca/gettingbetter or call Info Sociale 811. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
From November 12th to December 2nd, one of North America's major documentary film festivals will take place.
Montreal International Documentary Festival.
RIDM.
A 23rd edition, more engaged and accessible than ever.
In a virtual format never seen before.
The program includes the 100 best documentaries of the year.
This fall, we will be online, where all stories meet.
And you?
Check out our website at ridm.ca.
The COVID-19 pandemic in Canada is serious. We must continue to practice all public health measures. Follow local guidelines for gatherings, maintain physical distancing, wash your hands, wear a mask, and download the COVID Alert app. If you have symptoms, even mild ones, stay home. Protect yourself and others. Learn more at canada.ca/coronavirus or 1-833-784-4397. A message from the Government of Canada.
This is Democracy Now!
So I'm confident that the fact that they're not willing to acknowledge we won at this point is not of much consequence in our planning and what we're able to do between now and January 20th.
President-elect Joe Biden's moving ahead with transition plans as President Trump falsely claims the election was stolen from him. Even Trump's own Department of Homeland Security says the election was the most secure in American history. We'll speak to the New Yorker magazine's Jane Mayer about her new article, Why Trump Can't Afford to Lose. Then we go to Florida. That's the sound of supporters cheering Desmond Meade as he comes out of a polling place after voting for president for the first time in 30 years. 2 years ago, Desmond Meade led an effort to restore voting rights for Floridians who were disenfranchised due to their felony records.
At the heart of Amendment 4 was the fact that we abolished a 150-year-old Jim Crow law in Florida. Prior to Amendment 4 passing, anyone convicted of a felony offense faced a lifetime bar from voting. And so we effectively removed that.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Democracy Now!